Welcome back or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and this is another episode of the Long Run Archives with my frequent co-host, Brett Hornig. We talk about Brett's new YouTube channel, the first place tie at Ultra Trail Cape Town, the timing of the 2023 World Trail Championships, the idea of no pacers at Western States, contract season for pro runners, and UTMB Thailand. Before we get started, though, this episode is brought to you by Gnarly Nutrition and Kodiak Cakes. Use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout for Gnarly Nutrition and use code SINGLETRACK15 at checkout for Kodiak to get great discounts off their products. With that, let's get started. All right, we're back for another edition of the Long Run Archives. This is our eighth edition. It's kind of cool that I think we kicked this off back in January of this year, so we've had a full calendar year doing it, and I hope that in 2023 we can be a little bit more frequent, but we've kind of averaged like one every 4 to 6 weeks. Before we get into sort of the bulk of the episode, though, we do have a special, in my opinion, extremely exciting announcement. My frequent co-host colleague here at Single Track, Brett Hornig, is starting a slightly new venture. So, Brett, what is this? Delight the audience in what one of your next endeavors is going to be.
Yeah, this has been something that I guess it's kind of been in the works. I don't know if I want to say like secretly, but we've just been working on it for quite a few months now, and I think it's just about ready. And that is, I'm starting a YouTube channel, and it is going to be dedicated, at least to start, dedicated primarily to in-depth trail shoe reviews. And the reviews are going to be, they're going to have a little twist on them, which we'll get to in a sec, but the channel is going to be called Conversational Pace, which just seems fitting because Single Track Podcast one and only Finn Melanson is going to be my co-host for these trail shoe reviews. I'm pretty excited about that. We've already recorded some episodes, and it's been a lot of fun because most shoe reviews are one person talking into a camera, you know, saying what they like or dislike about a shoe, which is still something we're going to do, but we get to do it in a little bit more conversational back and forth type format. So, you know, the structure of the show essentially is Finn and I each get the same model of shoe to run in. Finn being over in Salt Lake City and me being in Ashland, Oregon, we have pretty two different types of terrains that we're running on. We also have pretty different feet. That then leads to some pretty fun findings and conversation after we do an amount of running in the shoes and come together and talk about what we think. And, you know, the whole goal of the channel essentially is to, you know, educate people on how some of these shoes work, what might be best for them, which, you know, if that's going to keep people healthy and enjoying running on the trails, that's something that I want.
One thing before we get more into like what this will look like for listeners, I think that the name is absolutely brilliant. I remember a couple weeks back you texted me the name, and I feel like typically when someone's coming up with a name for a business or an idea, it takes like a ton of back and forth. It takes a ton of ideation. I just finished reading Shoe Dog, and I remember early on in the days of Nike, Phil Knight was really working on pushing his team to go with the name Dimension 6, which I think is hilarious. But like you, I think, struck gold with this name of Conversational Pace, which I don't know if it's like a double entendre, but you can just go in so many different directions with it beyond shoes, which I think is super cool. And I don't know what you talked earlier about, like there being a certain formula for these shoe review videos on YouTube and podcasts out there. I've always joked, but been pretty serious that you're like, you have like a PhD in shoes. Like there's nobody else I'd rather consult with when it comes to like, what I'm going to be wearing on my feet for a coming season. So given that you're like a super fan in this area, what do you like about the current, scene, and what are you looking to, make your own as well?
So I like to think of myself more as a sommelier than just a shoe person with a PhD, because there's so much art and opinion that goes with liking and disliking a shoe, as very much is the case with wine. So I actually almost see more parallels there. But there's, especially, so the running event in was in Austin, Texas, just a few weeks ago. And that's when most of the shoe companies kind of take the sheet off of a lot of the new or updated shoe models for the 20, you know, for the next season. And for 2023, there is kind of a crazy push into trail from all the brands with a ton of new models and a ton of different ideas. And really kind of the first, we're going to see the first full year of attempts from multiple companies in the trail super shoe market. Will it actually be, you know, as a magical of a, you know, revolution in trail running as with the roads in 2016? I guess we'll find out, but I think, you know, this next year is going to be a really fun one for trail shoes, because there is a ton of different stuff coming out, whole bunch of crazy ideas and really fun materials. And, you know, we're going to try and sort through the good, the bad, and the ugly, and, you know, give people some, you know, a little bit better educated decision making on which of these shoes might be best for them.
I totally forgot to establish your street cred in this scene before we even got into conversational pace. I know it, but can you talk about like what you were doing back in college and even these last like 5 to 10 years developing your knowledge around road and trail shoes?
I mean, I've been kind of like in and around the shoe industry since high school. I mean, I got my first job was working at a Fleet Feet in the Bay Area, getting to talk to the reps and just learning about the shoes and how they work. But, you know, I think then also learning about like Nike and, you know, initially reading Bowerman and the Men of Oregon and Bill Bowerman, you know, crafting shoes in his garage with his waffle iron, like that's led me to tinkering around with shoes a ton in my own garage and making some pretty fun, you know, hybrids. And, you know, even just tweaking trainers to work better with my foot, and actually also tweaking trainers for friends and teammates as well, which has also led to a little bit of wear testing for various companies as well. So getting to actually talk to, you know, employees within some of these bigger shoe companies who are the ones designing and giving input, and, you know, actually just having back and forth conversation with them about, you know, what works, what doesn't, where do we see this going? That's definitely given me a very unique perspective on just the shoe industry as a whole. And then to pair that with actually having been selling, you know, running shoes at a specialty run store, worked at Rogue Valley Runners for like 8 years. You know, so seeing it on the ground floor, that, you know, shows me that like, this is who our consumer is. This is what they want. Mm.
You also, didn't you write a thesis or a final paper in college around this?
Oh yeah. That was, we had to do a whole business plan to finish up business school here at SOU. And the whole business plan was centered around a running specialty store that did in-house custom 3D printed orthotics. So like we got super nerdy on that one.
cool. Well, in terms of like the content that's being produced and the cadence, what can listeners expect in terms of like the release date of the first episode and where to find you and stuff like that?
So, I mean, I guess if all goes to plan, once this episode drops, there should be a link in the show notes to the YouTube channel. Yep. Where people can go. And I guess announcement number two is for the first video that we're releasing, which is the Brooks Caldera 6. We got to partner with Running Warehouse on that first video. And if you subscribe to the channel and watch the video, watch the review, comment on the video of a 2023 running or race goal, that will enter you into a contest with Running Warehouse, where we get to pick two random people from the comments, and they will each get a pair of Brooks Caldera 6. So, you know, big appreciation to Running Warehouse for helping out with the launch of Conversational Pace.
Right on. Well, I, for one, think this is a long time coming. I'm super excited. I feel like you bring the perfect balance of expertise and relatability to the audience. And it's just good to have you in another lane of the content creation space here in the running community. So huge congrats. And yeah, we'll spell out that giveaway or that contest in the show notes, as well as that link. Before we get into like the meat of the episode, Ultra Trail Cape Town stuff, this ITRA National League, et cetera, any final thoughts for the listeners on Conversational Pace?
Yeah, I guess the last thing, it just kind of popped into my head, was I would love to hear, you know, message one of us. What shoes are you excited about for 2023? Is, you know, if we get a whole bunch of people saying like, I want to know more about this shoe, like we will try our best to go and run and review it. And I guess the other thing with these more in-depth reviews is our goal is to put a minimum of 100 miles on trail in each of these shoes before we go to the review. So we can at least talk a bit more on durability, which, you know, that's a huge, that's so important, especially as these shoes are getting more and more expensive. You know, like you can't run 20 miles on the shoes and then give an honest, you know, opinion on like, oh yeah, this is absolutely going to last 400 miles. Like some of the shoes we didn't even like after 20 miles and they took 50 miles to actually grow on us. So, you know, that's just kind of the other thing, is we're going to actually run a decent amount in these shoes.
Moving on to Ultra Trail Cape Town, you and I probably did way more research for this event. We learned more about this event than we ever thought we would have at this point in time. I was pleasantly surprised, and I had a great time watching the live coverage, interviewing the athletes, doing that pre-race interview with you and Leah. I know you felt the same, but did this race meet the expectations that I think we had for it going in? What are your thoughts there?
You know, I mean, the biggest bummer is just the time zones from the US, you know, like the 100K started at, I think, 8 p.m. and then went until, what, 3 a.m., 4 a.m. So that just made for a tough viewing schedule. But from what I was able to see when I was awake, the coverage was incredible. Like, that course was stunning. The commentating was incredible. It was continuous. They sprinkled in athlete, you know, like insights and interviews to learn about some of the people and their background and, you know, where they came from, how their training's been, what races they had already done this year. So from a coverage standpoint, it was, I feel like it was just as good as UTMB's. What do you think?
The same. Yeah. And I feel like there were nice little additions to the coverage as well. Like seeing the bikes with the GoPros attached, following like Hillary Allen, for example, at various parts of the 100 mile. I liked how they took time at each of the aid stations to interview crew members or any just interesting people that were respected in the race. Like those were cool little additions that I hope to see sprinkled into other events in our sport. But yeah, I think we were promised like a state of the art live coverage experience. And I loved it. And I think it's just part of this new trend where like our generation of runners and maybe the generations below us, we appreciate being met where we're at. Like we appreciate being able to watch content on like Netflix, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, live streams, YouTube, not like traditional cable. And races like Ultra Trail Cape Town are recognizing that and they're making it happen. And it makes me excited because I feel like they're building the viewing infrastructure that is going to last and grow fans and grow the sport for like years to come.
Yeah, I agree. I'm so excited to see where they go from here. I do believe Ultra Trail Cape Town deserves to be one of the premier events, maybe the premier end of the season trail event. You know,
it's an interesting question. Can you be a premier end of the season event without being affiliated with something bigger. And my hunch has been they can, especially after seeing the athletes they were able to recruit and the investment from all of these sponsors and in the media that happened around it. Like, they can. And now that they can, I'm interested to see how this plays out in future years for our sport as a whole.
You said, you know, can they be the race that kind of goes independently without being a part of something bigger? I think they might be the something bigger. Yeah. You know, like, that you don't need to run Ultra Trail Cape Town to qualify for something else. You go run Ultra Trail Cape Town.
Right.
There you go. Like, I see that kind of being, I see that being the case moving forward, just with the effort that has been put into the race, you know, across the sponsors, the volunteers, race director, and kind of, you know, his long-term vision. I think they definitely have a future, you know, as being one of the premier races. And, you know, even this year, you know, amidst all of the racing that happened, they still had a stacked field. And that was also while introducing a new 100-mile event. So I think it can only get bigger.
And I know we're going to talk about the value of an off season, both from like a recovery standpoint and just from like a fan experience standpoint. But the only issue that I see here potentially is like this continuing legacy in our sport of this, like a lack of a clear end to end season long narrative. Like, it seems like, especially now that Cape Town has shown this year and in years past that it's going to be a great event that attracts people, elite athletes, no matter what. Is it going to be the case for years to come that we're just going to have this like medley of events, at least in the mountain ultra trail space, from like 100K to 100 mile, that athletes go and do regardless of what they mean in the bigger context of the sport, like a series or a league or anything like that? I think it's great that the athletes feel free to go and do that. But from like a fan building standpoint, I worry that because people are just kind of picking and choosing things without an overarching structure, it's going to be hard for fans to follow along and get like meaning out of a season. And that could just be me, but does any of that, do you have any thoughts there?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely love leagues, you know, in terms of, you know, a larger association that has teams and races and culminates to a championship where a team or an individual can win. But the one thing that a lot of these leagues have in common that ultra running does not is the ability to pump out a lot of these events, you know, over the course of a shorter season. Like, you just can't have 12 different ultras that everyone competes at and then leads to a big finale. You know, it's tough in that regard, just because it's the amount that you can't race for ultra running. So that might just be our sport, where we do need to have, you know, a whole bunch of, I guess, like almost like private championships where, you know, maybe there's smaller little tune-up races in between, but then it's just like you have a couple just big giant head honchos of races that people go to. Which it's interesting because like the sport, like we're just growing with it. Like there is no, I don't think there's a correct answer yet where it's like, oh man, we need to be doing this. I don't think really anyone knows what the absolute right answer is to, you know, get the best growth out of this sport from a competitor and fan, like, and media standpoint.
I do think your point about, especially at the 100K and 100 mile distance, the inability to run athletes through like a bunch of events in a short time span, that could be one of the major issues here. And that's why each race has to be like an end in and of itself. It has to be like a standalone thing. We can't have like the Golden Trail series for like these larger distances, right? Like, you couldn't just have these athletes running like through like 600 Ks in like a 8-week span. It's just not going to work. But I don't know. We were talking offline about how I think the golden ticket series here in the US with Western States is probably the most satisfactory example of like a season kind of league thing. It's not a league, but it has like a narrative to it that can excite fans. You can really identify with the athletes that are going through the process of trying to get one of those entries to Western States. To me, that's the closest thing we have. And I see how much fandom that creates here in the US. And I just wonder, like, can we and should we try to replicate that elsewhere? It doesn't seem like it's catching on with the UTMB World Series, which is why I think that this is such an interesting conversation.
Yeah. And like, I understand why it works for Western States. There's only 369 spots on the start line at Western States. Like, they're kind of forced to create a series of races to get in, you know, to the race. For something like UTMB, where there's like, what, 2,000 or 3,000 spots to start the race, why pigeonhole yourself into limiting the number of potential elites that can come to the race? Because
like, that's a great point.
Like, are they doing this? I mean, I know one of the main reasons for doing this is like UTMB has an opportunity to make a lot more money across the races that are not UTMB. But did they also create this model because they saw how successful this model is for Western States? And like, I just don't think it's scalable to a 3,000 per person race. I think if Western States was allowed to have 3,000 people, there wouldn't be 6 golden ticket races where the top 2 in each race get to auto qualify for Western States. They would probably have something a little bit bigger, a little bit more grand.
I think it's a great point. I think like all our friends on running Twitter are already in the know, but I think that one of the least appreciated or even in the know facts about UTMB now is that there are like 25 quote unquote golden ticket equivalent races out there where the top 3, or maybe is it the top 10, they get automatic entry into
UTMB. I think it depends on the race.
Depends on the race. Like the World Series affiliated ones, it's top 3 and they get that automatic entry. And like, that's absolutely thrilling, but I don't know. It doesn't seem like it would be fascinating if you're right. And like Andrew Messick and all those people there that are building up the series, like that, like they were just taking from the golden ticket Western States playbook to build that out. I feel like they got to do a little bit of a better job promoting it though, because it's as a fan, like it's, if you know it's there, it's fun to follow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Which we're kind of like jumping a bullet point and coming back, but I feel like this transitions well into UTMB Thailand, because it talks about both UTMB and Western States, which,
let's do it.
Yeah. I bet there's a lot of people don't even know, but like, how long have you known that UTMB Thailand 100 mile was a golden ticket race for Western States?
I mean, I guarantee you there's like 15 people listening to this episode right now that are screaming into their headphones, like, of course I know, like, how dare you like belittle my ultra running knowledge? Like, I'm there on Twitter, but most of them don't, I bet. And I agree. I think you make a very good point.
And my other question, my follow-up to that was, oh, wow. It's a Western States golden ticket. Like the top 2 people in the 100 mile at UTMB Thailand get automatic entry to Western States. One, who's going? It was really hard to find that list. And two, I then looked at the course and it was just kind of like a, why is this a golden ticket race type scenario again? Because UTMB Thailand is as hard as UTMB. There's 30,000 feet of climbing and descending. And there's a warmer weather element to it, but like it's going to take forever. And I just don't know how like measurable that is to success at Western States. I mean, the counter argument in my head is like, if you're good at running, you're good at running. So if you win UTMB Thailand, like you probably have a chance at being pretty decent at Western States because you're good at running, but it just doesn't quite seem like it's that great of a, like a litmus type test.
I can't remember if it was you who said it or me, but it's like if you ran a fast marathon and that gave you an OTQ in the 10K for the Olympics. Like it just, it's apples and oranges. To me, it's bewildering.
Yeah. Like it can work. And like, maybe we'll be eating our words because we'll see like the top two people at UTMB Thailand go and take the top two spots at Western States in 2023. But I don't know.
And they could, because to your point, because like at the end of the day, like good runners are good mountain ultra trail runners are good mountain ultra trail runners. And a lot of them have crossover ability. So like, it's not out of the question, but like, I think your original point of like why this race, it doesn't line up at all.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I guess we'll see who qualifies because that could tell more of the story. I mean, I know there's, I don't recognize a ton of the names in the elite field. I mean, I think the only on the men's side where the US representation is Rod Favard.
Yep.
So yeah, I like his chances.
You know what though? All these new international races, and now that we're kind of putting bigger emphasis on UTMB and stuff like that, it has inspired me. I think my New Year's resolution for 2023 is to get my bachelor's degree in the international racing scene and to become really familiar with like all these runners in China and Japan and Thailand and the Euro scene as well. Like, I don't know. I feel like it's on us now to we should be recognizing like 30 of these people, right?
Yeah, I agree. And these races have to meet us halfway because we should have been able to see a full elite field for the last month leading up to this race. And we didn't see it until just the other day when they made like the UTMB Thailand site live with the coverage ready and everything. Cause then it has the people published. So now you can see who the top people are by their UTMB ranking. It's not that deep.
No, I mean, the 100-mile event is the golden ticket. I recognize two names. You mentioned Rod and then Gediminas Grinius, who's had a lot of success at Western before. The 100K is more competitive, and I'm guessing those folks are trying to punch a ticket to CCC. But I see Jason Schlarb, Rich Lockwood, Scotty Hawker, Sinmaya Buddha, Hannah Allgood, Ryan Whalen. So a little bit more like Western.
And those are all for the 100K.
Those are for the 100K, yeah. So like a little bit more US American depth there. But you said that this race could be the ultimate cherry pick for a golden ticket to Western States. Can you talk more about that?
I mean, I guess we'll see, because there's still a handful of golden ticket races left. But you know, the least competitive or the least deep of the golden ticket races is in hindsight the one that would have been the easiest to get into a golden ticket at. And like, as of right now, I think this is that one. On the other hand, you have to go run 100 miles with 30,000 feet of climbing. So like, that's not a cherry pick. And that is a massive amount of suffering for a, you know, 15-hour race. But if you could do that and survive it and get away, you know, like relatively unscathed, like that might be easier for some than, you know, having to go up against, you know, Adam Peterman and like Jasmine Lothar at Canyons.
I do think we should timestamp this moment too, because I feel like it's end of 2022. I do feel like either next year or in the coming years, our complaints about not having timely information or in-depth information about runners, it's going to come to an end. And I think that like, we'll talk about like Free Trail in a second and the database they're building and even what UTMB started to build. But I am really optimistic that really soon it's going to be easy for commentators like you and me to provide really in-depth analysis and getting to know each of these runners and making informed picks and stuff like that. And, you know, until now it's been super difficult. We talked about this in the Battle of the Brands episode as well, but I think it's changing and I'm stoked about that. It's going to be fun to be a media person, really fun to be a media person from here on out, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's already been fun to be a media person, but I think it's going to be more fun just as, you know, we have more knowledge and more ability to chat and gossip about what's going on in the trail running world. Speaking of chat and gossip, like one thing that there was a lot of hot takes on Twitter. We're kind of jumping a little bit back and forth, but that's just how Long Run Archives works.
Oh yeah, no, this is informal.
Going back to Ultra Trail Cape Town, we got to address the tie on the men's side.
We do. Okay. I think that, well, actually, I thought that when we were talking offline, I thought that your take on this was really well reasoned, but I will say this before you offer it. This is new to me. Apparently, both Hannes Nuremberger and Dmitry Mityaev, who tied for first place, they're both getting first place bonuses from their personal sponsors, but the race money, what's happening is they're dividing the sum total of the first and second place amounts mm-hmm. and splitting it evenly because all the prize money was allocated pre-event. And mm-hmm. this is according to, I saw a post in the Free Trail Slack from Corinne Malcolm. So that actually changed my perspective on this a little bit because I know that we'll probably talk about like what happens from like a prize money standpoint if people tie. And I guess they're just dividing the combination of first and second place winnings.
That is how like ties have traditionally gone and like, you know, smaller races from, you know, like a prize money standpoint, you know, ties on the track don't really exist because it's camera timed and they go down to the thousandth of a second. And if there is ever actually a tie, there are in a championship setting, so like through USATF's rules, this actually happened. I'm pretty sure it was either 2012 or 2016 in the Olympic trials. In one of the rounds of the women's 100, there was a tie. I forget if it was for first or second place, but it was significant because it was either determining who made the Olympic team or determined who went to the next round. And what happens is when there is a legit tie, they have two choices and the runners get to make the choice. You either A, have a runoff where they go one-on-one again for that event, have a runoff. Two, coin flip, which I cannot believe that that's the second choice is a coin flip. And I can't remember what they picked, but I guess the point is there's a tiebreaker. Like you're not allowed, they're not allowed to tie. Like it's a tie, which I don't know. I always just kind of thought that like the whole point of like professional racing was racing. And when you're racing, you're trying to win. And these two did not try to win. I personally didn't love that. I understand like a situation where like, you know, you're leading the race and like just shit weather rolls in. And like now you're going from trying to win to trying to survive. So if it makes sense for the sake of safety to group up and like try and get off the mountain or complete the course in a safe manner that gives, you know, increases your chances of survival and you happen to be in first with other people, I understand that. But that was not the case at Ultra Trail Cape Town. You know, we saw the footage. It was windy, but it was warm and it was beautiful out. So I don't know. I don't think either of these runners were like under duress in regards to challenging weather. I was reading on Twitter. Well, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you, and this is about like chip timing, but let's say that Hannes and Dmitry had not opted to go for a tie and they gutted it out to the, like they were racing hard right to the finish. And let's just assume for argument's sake or the situation's sake that like they both like dive over the finish line, like trying to get first place. Are those chip timers accurate enough down to a thousandth of a second? Like, or do you need like instant replay to see like whose foot or head like got over the line first? Like if they actually tried to gut it out and it was super close, like how would you legislate that?
It should be a camera, you know,
okay.
That's right down along the finish line. Like it's how they do it in road, track, cycling, triathlon. They have a finish camera and it shows, you know, it's your body. So like when you lean, it's not your forehead. It's like your torso, you know, like those are just the rules. So like if it came down to a lean, it would be who's like chest crossed first, which their bib numbers were, they have the chip in them, but like, what if I outleaned you, but my bib is attached to my shorts, and that's my trail leg at the time. And I outlean you, but the chip time says I lost. That's where the chip timing is not accurate and the camera becomes more accurate. The counter argument is like, when is that going to happen at the end of 100K?
Yeah. Well, what were you gonna say about Twitter there before I interrupted you?
So I read on there, which actually makes sense, that there is financial motivation as a professional athlete to tie. Because in the results for a tie, they both are listed as T-1 and T-1. And then Drew Holman, who got third, is third. So the leaders tied for first and Drew got third and there was no second. Since they both tied for first, they are both making first place money from their sponsors. Haven't seen...
And all the other trappings that come with that.
Yeah, because I've never heard anywhere in like a professional contract from anyone where if you tie, you don't get first place money, you know, or it gets reduced or treated a second. Because from a sponsor standpoint, you know, Nomberger and, you know, Dimitri, they both did cross the finish line first. So like their sponsors were displayed front and center. Like from a sponsor standpoint, it kind of did its job. So they get paid for that. So like they're not actually that incentivized to beat the other person either if the other person is also on the same page as them and is like, well, if we just come in together, we're both going to get paid.
Yeah.
So my hot take is, and this could totally just come down to the race. I mean, Ultra Trail Cape Town as an independent race, they could create this rule if they wanted. Instead of being T-1, if you tie and you tie with someone else and it's not like a fair fight to the finish, you're both now T-2 because nobody won. And they have T-2, and then Drew as third. And then they get paid out as second from their sponsors.
And what I'm about to say here, this is not in any way, shape, or form a reference to these two athletes. It's to the concept of two elite athletes tying in general and what the motivations could potentially be. This could be interpreted as collusion, given that there's a pretty significant amount of money involved relative to our sport, given that, you know, there are athletes in the sport. If you look at their contracts, bonuses can take up an outsized portion of it. It's really important for these podiums to happen, for these first places to happen. There's a lot on the line. I highly doubt, especially thanks to the live coverage that we saw, I highly doubt. In fact, I would assume that there's a 0% chance that Hannes and Dimitri were having any, you know, conversations about like, hey, like, you know, if we do this, X, Y, and Z are going to happen. But that's out there. It's a distinct possibility, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's rules against that in you know, I guess that goes back to the league and like the organization, like some, you know, higher level of rule makers, you know, like in like USATF and in the Olympics, like there are rules in the rule books against things like that. Where like, if you're not putting out what is deemed an honest effort, you can be disqualified.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm guessing those rules were created because there was evidence or suspicion of that happening pre-rules.
Well, and I mean, I think a lot of it was to combat betting. It's like, what if I bet a whole bunch of money that, you know, Hannes Nomberger, you know, maybe even wins, but maybe just I bet that he won't lose. And like, you know, there's situations where like people could be paid off to then just go and tie if that's a situation. It's like, oh, they didn't lose. Now I make lots of money and I'll give him an amount too.
What? Sports betting is going to come to ultra running, I would assume, sooner rather than later. Like, we're already seeing the infrastructure built out, like with, you know, you and I both play fantasy free trail. It's a lot of fun. I actually don't know. I'd have to go back and look at the results for Ultra Trail Cape Town, but how were those tie points allocated? Like, how did that all work out? Do you know?
That's a good question. I don't actually know because I didn't guess them right. That's not to say I did bad in fantasy free trail. I actually thought I did really good. I thought I was going to win. Like,
you texted me like, dude, I did so good.
Which apparently the race was very predictable, because while I didn't guess the places for the names exactly. I think I was like plus or minus one place for the top five men and the top five women. Like I had 8 of 10 names correctly, just with their places like flip-flopped one. And that was only good for 70th or 71st. I remember you beat me by like 2 damn spots.
I think we were like, we were like 68 and 69th or something like that.
So I really want to know who won and what their card looked like, and would love to see the scoring, the point breakdown. Cause at the moment on Fantasy Free Trial, like I can only see my own pick card and the points for it.
Yep.
But like, I would love to see just like the winners of like, this is what the winner picked.
How about like, if we talk philosophically about ties at the front end of the sport, like I should state for the record that it is not uncommon. In fact, I'm guessing it's pretty frequent in our sport for people to cross the finish line together, to hold hands. You know, it happens in the back of the pack. It happens in the middle of the pack. It's been brought to my attention that, you know, for example, Dylan Bowman at Ultra Trail Pre-New tied for 7th place intentionally, I think. So it's not uncommon, but I don't know. What are your thoughts on how this all played out, just from like a philosophical standpoint?
I mean, I'm just not a huge fan of it. Like I don't know. Maybe that's just like the track and cross country, like always having like I've always competed for a team first and then myself second. So like, it's just so ingrained in me that like, you need to be ahead of the person that's right next to you, because that could be the make or break difference between your team winning and losing. And that's just what I've taken into all of my races. And I haven't gone into a race where I've run into a situation where like the weather is so horrible, you know, it's like, I feel unsafe and I want to stick with someone for the sake of safety. That hasn't happened to me yet. So I like personally haven't come across a situation, but like, I would rather, you know, I'll sleep better at night knowing I tried to beat everyone next to me. And if they beat me, I will still sleep just as good because I did what I could. So yeah, I don't know. That's my own like personal take on ties.
Yeah. I think I'm in the same boat as you, and maybe this is more a reflection on my lack of psychological development, if anything, but I always get a little bit mad when people have like transcended competition and they can get to the finish line, like not caring if they've won or lost. Like, I feel like Dimitri and Hannes are just probably like super evolved human beings. And like, they've just realized that like, there's a whole nother plane of existence that is out there. And if you could just see it, it's way more important than any given race. And I'm like, damn it. Like, you're probably super right. But like,
oh, I agree.
Let us enjoy our competition.
I know. If you've they've transcended to the point where they can just go and enjoy the day and finish together like a long run, except they also just happen to be so damn good at running that they finished in first and second. And that's probably the part that bugs me the most, is that I'm like, you guys weren't even trying and you still beat everyone. I hate you.
There are a lot of days where I feel like I'm in the wrong sport. Like I should be doing like MMA coverage or something like that, because all those people are willing to like talk shit and like, they want to like beat the hell out of each other and like win, and they want someone to lose. And I'm just like, people in ultras are just too chill. I don't know.
Which on the other, like, I love that part of this where like, I like friendly competition.
Yeah.
That's really what it is that I like, where it's like, we're going to go battle on the course, but right afterwards, like, I'm going to give you a big giant sweaty hug and say good game. Yeah. Like every time.
Should we talk about the ITRA National League?
Yeah. You texted or emailed this to me. You're like, this is going to be a great talking point for the long run archives, the launch of the ITRA National League. And like, my response was, what the hell is that? And then you sent me a link to the webpage, and then my response was, what the hell is that? So Finn, we're going to need some elaboration from you.
I think everybody, including anybody that would call themselves an ultra running nerd, is in a state of absolute confusion and chaos right now when it comes to this whole international league. There's this marketing concept, which you learn super early on in business school. It's called the 5-second test, where you should be able to, when you go to a website, within 5 seconds, before even scrolling down the page, you should know what this website's about, why you should care, and what the next step is that you should take. And if you go to ITRA and you apply that test, you could spend 5 seconds times 1,000 and you'd still not know what the hell is going on. It's super confusing. I have no idea. Like, and I went through the website. I took, so I'm probably gonna have to like read some notes to you here, because I still can't like organize it into a talking point. Yeah. But it seems like an environmental play. So, you know, the UTMB World Series, because all the races are so spread out, it's going to require athletes to travel to like really far away distances. Like if you're an American runner and you're on the East Coast and like you want to do like a qualifying event here in the US, I'm pretty sure like you're shit out of luck. And you have to go to like Utah or, you know, California or Mexico on the North American continent to go and get your stones. And this whole thing is saying like, look, we want to encourage you to do races that are in your home country. There's going to be a lot of them, like in the tens or the hundreds. They're all going to be super close to you. You can drive there within a couple hours. And if you do 3 races that are ITRA sponsored within your own country, by the end of the year, you'll have a ranking, and whoever has like the highest ranking in your home country, wins that given ITRA National League. But it kind of stops there. Like there's no prize money involved. It didn't really go into like what the meaning of it is beyond that. So there's a lot of like carrots, but the carrots don't really make sense. So the big takeaway for me is like, it's environmentally, they're trying to like pitch this whole like environmentally sustainable way of racing and to do more races in your backyard that are not like UTMB related.
And for clarification, these ITRA sponsored racers, these are races that already exist. Like they're not new races that ITRA is putting on. It's like,
yep.
In the past, and I think still currently, if you give ITRA, like as a race director, if you give them like $5 or $20 or something, yep. And you submit your course profile.
Yep.
I forget what else, number of people, like elevation, things like that. It generates, you know, like a course difficulty, and based off of like the numbers that you give them in the profile, your race gets yep. listed on the ITRA website. And that's yep. that's always gone towards individual runners competing in these races and then getting points, you know, a point total for the performance that contributes to their world ranking.
Yeah, I went to their like event organizing portion of the site, mm-hmm. and they currently have 556 events worldwide under this ITRA National League banner.
I don't think that's a very big number.
It's not huge, but I'm guessing they like grandmothered a bunch of
yeah.
you know, ITRA races
and
been there forever.
Aren't we also kind of assuming the whole winning part? Because on the homepage, it didn't even say, it didn't just leave off with, if you do 3 of these races, you'll be like, or I think it just said like the call to action was do 3 of these races locally to you.
Yeah, here, I'll just say this verbatim. Finish 3 National League races within the same country in a calendar year starting in 2023. Follow your ranking on their dedicated ranking page. The sum of your best 3 ITRA scores obtained in National League races gives you an overall score for your ranking. And it pretty much ends there.
So like, yeah, that leads to the assumption that you can win, but it doesn't say what you win.
No.
And
no, and yeah. you can also be ranked in multiple countries. So you can like do 3 races in America, 3 races in Spain, 3 races in Japan, and you can be on the boards for all of those, like independently.
And I can win an imaginary ITRA title 3 different ways.
Yeah.
But also I know, having, you know, gone through like the process of making a race become like ITRA certified. So that way, because back before the whole UTMB monopolization of 2022, ITRA and UTMB kind of worked together to generate difficulty for races, which determined how many like UTMB yeah. points you would get. So, and the system wasn't perfect, because from a point standpoint, like some of my race results, there was a couple where I knew like, so, you know, race X, it gave me a ton of points for and said that was my best race I've ever had, when I personally knew it was not. But another course I knew was my best race, but it gave me significantly less points because a computer just does not know how many rocks are out on the trail, how muddy it was that day, various like elevation, air density, like all the little things, the little variables that change the time of a trail race so much.
Yep.
This system doesn't know that. So like looking at it from a competitor standpoint, it would be easy for me to go and find the three best races that are going to get me the highest score if I race them. Because, you know, if I go and run a 50K in Ashland where the dirt is perfect, I'm going to get a much higher score than if I go to a 50K in Colorado, even if the profiles are exactly the same, because I'm just going to run 45 minutes faster in Ashland. So I'm probably going to get a lot more points for that. So that's me just poking holes in this new system already.
I know. 100% agree. And like, if we keep asking the question, like what's the incentive, even without having seen contracts over the years and knowing what races are on the lists for like, in, you know, encouraging runners to go do, you can just tell based on where all the elites go, where they're incentivized to be and where the bonuses are and stuff like that. Knowing what I know, which is not a lot, but it's a decent amount, knowing what I know, I don't think that there are very many races in this ITRA National League that sponsors care about. So it's interesting to me that they're building up this whole competition side of it when I think there's probably going to be it's going to be hard to draw the competition to it. I'm having trouble even putting words together because I'm so confused.
I would love to hear the 5-year plan. I don't know.
Yeah.
That transitions well into our next league qualifier.
One more thing. If anybody out there is more enlightened about this or sees things that we're missing that are important to consider about, you know, why this could be successful, et cetera, let us know. Of course, we're mostly talking about this in an elite runner competition context, so just keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Anyways,
I mean, even outside of the elite side of things, what's the motivation for someone who's not an elite to do this? I also don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah. All right. I'm ready.
So we just had the World Mountain Running Championships in Chiang Mai, Thailand. And we're already talking a lot about the next World Mountain Running Championships because they're normally every other year, but because it got pushed from 2020 to 2021, we now have another World Mountain Running Championships in 2022. And it's going back to its normal early summer, late spring date. So it's at the beginning of June over in Austria, in Innsbruck, right? So it's in Innsbruck, Austria, and USATF just announced, was it the USATF? Do I even have my organizations right?
USATF. Okay. By the way, Innsbruck has hosted the Winter Olympics twice, once in 1964, once in 1976. So just to set the ambiance, this is a pretty dang cool place.
I mean, I checked it out on Google Earth. It kind of looks like a bigger Chamonix. Like it's flanked by giant ass mountains on both sides and it looks super cool.
Yeah.
So that's at the beginning of June, and USATF just announced the qualifying races for getting in. And it's just kind of interesting that I just don't know if we need qualifying races for selecting this world's team. Like as much as that, like wouldn't benefit someone like myself, who's like definitely not in consideration for the World Mountain Running Team and would have a better chance to like cherry pick a spot at a qualifier race, for the sake of creating the best Team USA to send to Worlds, I don't see how that's done with the selection races that are in existence right now.
Well, to your point, didn't like Steve Prefontaine back in the day have like a similar criticism about other running events in the Olympics? Like we weren't we weren't creating a system that was sending our best possible athletes to these events.
So, yeah. So like when, like in the 70s and earlier than that, the Olympics, the US would only send amateurs to the Olympics because that was kind of in the spirit of the Olympics, at least the way we saw it. So you couldn't be making money as a runner if you wanted to make the Olympic team. And yeah. Steve Prefontaine thought that was bullshit because they were, you know, a lot of them were running better, you know, than many professional runners who are just running on a pro circuit, but not eligible to make the Olympic team. And he's like, why am I breaking American records every other day trying to make this Olympic team and I'm not making any money? And like,
yeah,
that's just for the sake of me representing my country in the Olympics. Like, and I don't get to make any money for it.
Yeah.
Where were we going with that in regards to trail?
Well, and this is, by the way, this is, and I don't say that to instigate any criticism of the teams that we've sent, because I mean, our men's 80K team just won the gold. So obviously like great team. And we just last year or this year, we sent great teams over. But I know you mentioned in the notes that there are countries out there that don't have like a race qualifying process. They just select teams. And I wonder, like, over the years, are we going to in aggregate put ourselves at disadvantages by not just having like a selection process independent of qualifying? Like, do we make it less democratic in a good way?
Yeah. I mean, that so much of that just comes down to how corrupt the people selecting the teams are. Like, you know, Ethiopia is one of the best long distance running countries in the world, and their government selects their Olympic team without a trials, you know, where you get to, you know, race and then the best three on that day get to go represent their country in the Olympics. Like, that's how the US does it. And in a lot of cases, that doesn't necessarily pick the best team because you get the three best people on that particular day. What if like the obvious gold medal favorite is sick or just has an off day, they trip, they don't make the Olympic team? We are now not sending our best team. We're sending our most fair team because I believe that's the most fair way to qualify.
Yep.
But with how many different trail races there are and like quote unquote championships, and this being in June, we've got people working for UTMB, trying to get into Western States, doing Broken Arrow, Golden Trail. Is there really room for another qualifier race? So like for the 40K at Worlds, the top three spots from the formidable 50K in Auburn, California in February will make that 40K spot. Like, again, those races are very different. And then for the long race, the 80K at Worlds, the qualifier race for that is in April, and it's the Lake Sonoma 50 mile.
It's been proven that a race like Lake Sonoma totally prepares you for an 80K, 16,000 feet of climbing race out in Innsbruck. No question.
I mean, I haven't seen the course yet over in Innsbruck. Maybe it's 200 little climbs and descents, and Lake Sonoma is actually perfect. But if I had to take a guess, I would say no. And I understand why Formidable and Lake Sonoma are the qualifying races, because those are two nice opportunities to have a qualifying race to make the world team. It still seems forced to me, though, when they could just let people go race and then at the end of, you know, March or April, send out a bunch of emails to people who've been crushing it in the last 6 to 12 months and be like, do you want to go race Worlds?
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And I mean, it seems to me like they're just abiding by a system that they created that, they're just deciding not to be flexible about, even when, you know, they had to postpone a year due to COVID. I mean, the good news is, I think, you know, starting after this one, they're back to a 2-year schedule. Mm-hmm. And I saw this on the website, actually. The next one is going to be in June 2025. And letters of intent for the host region were due on December 1st, a week ago. So I'll be really curious to know where or what spot gets awarded. Selected.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Yeah, what was I going to say? I'm sure it'll come back to me at some point. It was just about the yeah, the selection process and the teams.
Also, like with Lake Sonoma, let's say that like the top three men and women, can we safely assume that they're all going to want to take that ticket to the world champs?
Yeah. And like, I think it also said it doesn't roll down.
I think
that's
down.
What the USATF says. It's like, what if someone's just running West or Lake Sonoma to tune up for Western states? And you have these people who just go run it. And then now we create no team. And then it goes down to a selection pool. We're back to where we started.
I also think, I know some people will say this is crazy. I think it's a fair debate to say which race is more exciting, or sorry, which event series is more exciting and enticing. Broken Arrow, which is happening at the exact, basically the exact same time in June, mm-hmm. or this World Championships.
I will say that I loved following World Champs in Thailand. I think that,
me too.
That I think Chiang Mai did an amazing job as playing host.
Yeah.
And I hope that Innsbruck, Austria can continue to ride that momentum, because I do think that the World Mountain Running Championships, I think their stock has the potential to tick up after this last Worlds. Like I think there's more people who want to run Worlds now than prior to Thailand.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the cool, yeah, 100% agree. And we were talking about this earlier, but there used to be three separate organizations that were hosting like similar things. You had the World Mountain Running Championships, the World Long Distance Mountain Running Championships, and the Trail World Championships. And those were put on by the World Mountain Running Association, the International Association of Ultra Runners. And I think World Athletics and ITRA had some involvement in there too. And like, finally, like that's all consolidated. And what we're talking about now, next June, is the consolidated version of all three of those things. And that's super cool to me, because there's just more like coherence. There's more like, this is, I can focus on this. There's nothing else that I could potentially consider on either side of it. Like, this is the one thing in that particular arena. So it's awesome.
Yeah, I guess it seems to be trending in the right direction, even after all of that, like what appears to be bashing that we just did on it. It does seem to be trending in the right direction.
No, I think it's awesome. If you had asked me like 6 months ago, would I be excited about the stuff? I would have said like, what even is that? I'm just not tuned in. And I think that like the work that a couple of our friends did over there, the stuff that Free Trail did, just the hearsay that we got from the runners we know.
Yeah. I mean, and as a result of all that, I'm signed up for Lake Sonoma.
Me too. Not that I'm going to qualify for the world's team, but I'm going to be there. I'm going to run it with you.
But you never know. Like because of worlds in Thailand, I signed up for Lake Sonoma because I'm like, shit, worlds in Austria could be super cool. And how many people are going to go do Lake Sonoma? I mean, I guess I hope it's a lot. I hope it's a super stacked race and we send a baller team. But yeah, like I think part of seeing how fun worlds was this last October was a huge influencer for why I signed up for Lake Sonoma.
I think I want to do, we can talk about it later, but I think it would be interesting to consider doing media coverage for Innsbruck.
I like that. I like the way this conversation could potentially be going.
We'll take it offline, but what else do we got here? Should we... Okay, I want to throw this question. Are you okay to move on?
Yeah, I think we did a good job covering that.
Here's a hypothetical question. What if we had the ability to know when athlete contracts were up and if they were free agents? Would that kind of information make our sport more interesting? Would it make being a fan of the sport more interesting? Yeah, what are your thoughts there?
I mean, I guess this really only pertains to the professional level of the sport, but I think that would make it immensely more interesting, because knowing that, you know, runner X, Y, or Z is in the last year of their contract with a particular brand and they're doing these races and they're absolutely crushing it. That's, and you know, and then maybe we also know that, oh, like, you know, this person's at the end of their Hoka contract and Saucony seems to be making a big push into trail. Like, is this runner's, you know, last year of their Hoka, is that opening up an opportunity for them to like jump over to another brand? Or, you know, just even just knowing like, oh, then they resigned. Like, I don't know. I just feel like it adds another layer of depth to the drama in some of these races and, you know, just gives the fans a little bit more in-depth reason of like maybe why this particular athlete is racing this race at this point in the year.
Yeah. Imagine. And like, how cool would it be to say this person just inked a 1-year deal with like whatever brand? Are they good enough to re-sign or get a bigger deal at the end of the year? Like,
yeah.
Like based on this race calendar that they just, you know, announced on Instagram with that 1-year deal, do they have the ability to perform at XYZ races? What do they need to do? I don't know. Like, stuff like that is super interesting to me.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing too, is like, if we knew, say, how many athletes were in the last year of their contract, we would be able to see like which brands as a whole are up for massive restructurings going into like the next year, or which brands are like pretty set, like, oh, this team doesn't appear like it's going to change much going into 2023. Oh,
yeah,
this team might look completely different going into 2023 because they have half of their athletes are at the ends of their contracts. Will they get re-signed? Is this team scaling down their numbers? Are they going to sign all these new people? What's happening there?
Yeah, it's like, why are they staying the same? Or why are they changing?
Yeah.
Is Solomon in a rebuilding year? Is Hoka betting on their current team? Like, there's just the storylines.
Yeah. Who's going to be a free agent in January? You know, if we know someone's like contract is up and then nothing gets announced going into the next calendar year, it's like, oh, like there's a story for that as well.
We see on ESPN, like in basketball and baseball and football, and I know that there's a totally different systems and environments there with unions and stuff like that. But I've always found it fun when you'll see like a player just signed a contract for like 6 years, $100 million, or, you know, these two players were involved in a trade, or this person was released. At the very least, I'd love to be able to like help tell the athlete stories, like when they've announced with a new team. Like, typically you'll see like 3 weeks after a contract has been signed, you know, an athlete might say, happy to announce I've just signed with Brooks. And I think that there's a lot of room in the sport to help amplify that somehow. I'm not exactly sure how it works, but like Sidious Mag kind of does it. Like, they'll do stuff even down to like the high school level. They'll announce like college signings. And I think that might be one of the low hanging fruit next steps for our sport. What do you think?
Sounds like one of the next steps for the Single Track podcast is to do some signing announcements.
I think it'd be kind of cool. I really do. I mean, again, yeah, I think it'd be cool.
I mean, I can see it. I can see it right now where you're there and me as the pro runner is sitting at my desk and there's six different hats on the table, all different brands, just like the high school football recruits do. And they like pick up the Hoka hat, toss it aside, pick up the Solomon hat. And they're like, nope. And then finally get to announce that it was actually like Dina Fit this whole time.
Yeah. Oh, what if this conversation was as normalized with athletes as the conversation about their training and racing lives were? Like, imagine if an athlete could go on a podcast and be like, I'm really frustrated with this brand. They're not treating me right. I demand the trade. Like, you see that all the time in like the NFL and stuff like that, like lockouts and holdouts and stuff like that. Like, I don't know.
Man,
it would just be so fun.
That would be. Looking at it from like an athlete manager standpoint, it would make me so scared to sign anybody because I would just be so worried that they're just going to start shit talking the brand and like not be happy. And maybe that's what teams need to like get a little bit more fair compensation for some of these professional trail runners. But I don't see that needle moving like at any point soon in regards to non-disclosure agreements in the contracts.
Yeah, I know that it's not in the interests of like any brand to disclose any numbers, but I feel like if there was one number they could part with, it could at least be like the years of the contract, so that we could at least kind of like date when the athlete signed, when they're getting ready to renegotiate.
Yeah.
And like at least talk about that part of it. Like it's great. Like we were just talking about this earlier. Like it's all happening right now. Like November, December, like we're in the depths of the contract negotiation, renegotiation, releasing process. It's an absolutely fascinating time to be an athlete. If you're friends with these athletes, it's equally as fascinating. And I know, or I have to imagine fans would love to like be a fly on the wall for this stuff, like we can't talk about
it. I know, like I'm not saying there is in these contracts, but if there was something in these professional contracts that said you as an athlete, if you're at your last year of the contract, when you're 30 days out from your contract expiring, you are now allowed to go talk to other brands and negotiate deals. If that was in their contracts, what if there was also something in the contract that's within those 30 days, you can also let in the media know that you are looking, that you're towards the end of your contract. Like there's a tiny compromise. Like we're not even now talking about the entire length of their contract. If we just knew that someone was in the last 30 days of their contract, that could give us something to talk about in the month of December.
I tweeted this out back in May and I just retweeted it today because I saw that this was going to be on the agenda and I think it's relevant. I said, quote, "One of the pivotal moments for the growth of a pro sport is when the operators realize that contract negotiations, trades, releases, rivalries, etc., they're not distractions from the game. They are part of the entertainment, and we are still a ways off in the trail and ultra running world from that being the case." Like,
yeah.
I don't know if fans of our sport watch ESPN and tune into like Stephen A. Smith and Skip Bayless and all the talk show, Colin Cowherd, all the talk show, Jemele Hill, but like people eat that stuff up. And it's such a, in my opinion, low hanging fruit way to enhance being a fan of trail runners.
Yeah. And you can look back on it and be like, oh, you know, in March when someone announces that they signed with a new brand, we can be like, oh, man, this whole past year, they were at the end of their contract with a brand and they were on fire. I wish I had known that at the time, because then I would have been rooting for them so much harder.
Can I give you this list of free agents that haven't been signed by a team that we know of yet for 2023?
Okay. Once you say a name, I will tell you if I also have that name written down, because I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I have 6 names written down.
Okay. The first one, Chad Hall.
Yes. I also have Chad Hall.
Garrett Corcoran.
Yes. I also have Garrett Corcoran.
Caleb Olson.
Oh, I don't have Caleb Olson.
Top American at CCC this
year. That is a good one.
Arlen Glick.
Yep. I have Arlen Glick.
Devin Yanko.
Oh,
shoe sponsor.
Oh, you're right. I don't have shoe sponsor. Devin Yanko definitely should be on that list.
Tabor Hemming.
Yep. I have Tabor Hemming.
Sarah Beal.
Yep.
Okay. And then my last one is Eddie Owens.
That's a good one. Eddie Owens he's fascinating. I want to learn more about Eddie Owens.
Tell us about the Strava find of the week.
Okay. So the Strava find of the week, Finn, it's your Strava find, but when you sent it to me,
this is Ryan Gelfie's.
Oh, this is Ryan. Ryan Gelfie's Strava find of the week on the Single Track podcast. It is perhaps, so this was the best, at least on the men's side, this was the best sub ultra trail race that happened in the US that nobody knows about. And it was the Spartan Trail Championships in Marin, brought to us by, is it just Spartan? Is that the people? I think that's the organization. Yeah. The obstacle course racing companies. They put on, they're trying to replace like the North Face 50 Mile And
yep,
their lack of marketing has just not done that. But for some reason, the half marathon, which was, it had over 2,000 feet of climbing and descending. I mean, on the most buffed out sections of the Marin Headland Trails and Fire Roads. But needless to say, it was still dirt until you cross the Golden Gate Bridge. That it was Eddie Owens. And for those who don't know, he just ran 2:13 at the CIM marathon this past weekend. He was charging on the lead pack so hard that they actually stuck cameras on him because he was the one moving the fastest of anyone on the field. Around like mile 18, 19, he moved up like six spots in 1 mile and everyone was like, who is this guy? And is he about to win and just steal the show from everyone? Unfortunately, he ran out of gas just a little bit in the last 2 miles, but for a brief moment there, it looked like he was about to rob the show. But he raced the Spartan Trail Championships half marathon in Marin against Chad Hall and Andy Wacker. And he beat both of them by multiple minutes. When Finn, when you sent me this Strava, I thought it was an error, but then, so then I went and looked at Chad Hall's and that one looked like even more of an error, but then like really analyzing it, it was like, oh my gosh, this was correct. There was a mile, there was a downhill mile, which was part of the North Face 50 mile course. So I remember it. And it's like just a smooth downhill dirt road that drops about 400 feet for the mile. So it's ideal for running fast. Eddie Owens was in the front leading and Andy Wacker and Chad Hall were chasing. And Eddie Owens dropped, he dropped like a, what was like a 4:16 on this mile. And I was just like, that has to be broken. Who throws down a 4:16 downhill mile in the middle of a trail half marathon when there's still more climbing? And then I go and look at Chad Hall's. He could see Eddie Owens and tried to catch him. Chad Hall, what was... Chad Hall ran a 4:06 or was it 4:03?
Yeah.
4:06.
Yeah. 4:06.
He had a 4:06 downhill mile in the middle of a trail half marathon. Both of these people are unsponsored and they were just, and then, you know, even their last miles coming off the Golden Gate Bridge were all sub-5. Like it was incredible. It was so fast.
Yeah.
And nobody knew about it and nobody saw it. And that's so sad.
One thing I want to ask you before we maybe go to our last topic, which I think is going to be like the, I wanted to talk with you about the crew or no crew option at Western States,
but before we get to that,
is maybe it was you that said this, but did you say that getting a golden ticket is no longer sufficient or warranting of a sponsorship?
I did.
Okay. Talk about that.
It kind of almost like had been, I don't know, maybe like 2016 to 2020. It almost seemed like all the golden ticket races were so competitive where if you got a golden ticket at any of these races, the next race you do, you're going to be wearing a kit from a brand and you are now sponsored. And with how deep the level of competition in the sport has been getting, I don't think getting a golden ticket at one golden ticket race is good enough now to sign a deal. You know, granted, it's like if you win this golden ticket race, like Jasmine Lowther, she's an example of proving what I just said wrong. She went and like blitzed the Canyons course against a super stacked field and won by a lot. Like that's not just getting a golden ticket. That's like winning the race, setting a course record. A course record by someone who had just won Western States. That's contract worthy. But like
Beth Pascal,
getting like second or third in that in one golden ticket race, I don't think's worthy of a contract anymore. Like I think you need a couple of those now with just how competitive it's getting.
Good points. Yeah, I think I agree. It's cool. Maybe one more thing to add there is it seems like we're in this era where it used to be the case that brands would have these teams of like 50 athletes. And now everyone is moving over to this model of like, let's nurture like 10 or 12 athletes. Let's pay them well. Let's give them a lot of attention. Let's give them coaching, PT, et cetera. And so it's just harder to be a sponsored athlete now too.
I think a big reason for that is like the the sport is starting to professionalize, and the person who works a full-time job and is on a gear contract is not going to be able to beat the people who are full-time professional trail runners. And if they are, then they could be crushing everyone if they went to that professional full-time kind of, you know, gig. So I think that's just where we're at in the sport.
I love it. I agree. I think that there might be some folks in the audience that would disagree with us, but
absolutely.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
All right. Last one. I want to give a shout out. I actually don't know the person's name because they had like a Twitter alias. They go by Dirt Runner on Twitter, but they texted me long run archives idea ... limited or no crews for elites at Western. Would love to hear your and Brett's thoughts on this one. I said, love it. I think we'll talk about it on the next episode. I got a heart emoji. I said, thanks. And here we are. So I wrote down some thoughts on this because I didn't want to forget them. I know you said that you talked about this at length, I think, a couple months ago. So I don't know what immediately comes to mind here.
No, I had this conversation with my dad at Thanksgiving just a couple weeks ago, because this is the type of conversation that happens during Thanksgiving with my family. And when I was in middle school and high school, he was racing like 200-mile road bike races pretty competitively. And we were talking about how some of the similarities and differences between, because they were like ultimately like 12-hour races. And I was like, oh my gosh, Dad, you were doing ultras when I was a kid. And like, I didn't even realize it. So like, you know, he relates so much to, you know, the type of running that I'm doing now. But one thing that we were talking about was, you know, he said, he was like, yeah, the elite and, you know, the elite field at Western States should have no crew to even the playing field. And it's just aid stations and drop bags only, because in our, I think it was our post Western States episode, we were kind of talking about how with where like cooling tech is going, are we in the golden, are we exiting the golden age of Western States where the heat will no longer be a difficulty factor at Western States anymore, because it'll just be so easy to stay cool when you have a giant crew and with all this cooling tech, that if you can afford it and you have the crew for it, Western States is no longer a hot race. So my dad was saying, he was like, yeah, in my bike races I was doing, like there was no, you weren't allowed to take any outside help. You know, if you wanted to make a drop bag and throw it at the aid station, you could do that. And then you had the aid stations, and then everything else was on you. Which I kind of love that idea for something like Western States, where you can make drop bags and you can use the aid stations and the volunteers, and that's it.
I got to disagree. I'm actually against the limiting or no crews at Western, at least for the professional part of the sport, because I think it's such a key part of the competition that can make or break a race in some circumstances. And I think I'm also for anything that adds complexity and depth to the sport too. Like I think about you and I being able to, and Leah being able to commentate future races, and how essential a part of it, like the watching the crew and analyzing the crew and maybe even talking to the crews will be. But think about what goes into it. Like over time, I think it will be even more serious than it is today. I think like there'll be people who, like you'll have runners like Jim Walmsley, and if he doesn't already do this already, he'll probably have like a truly professional crew that has like specialty in all the major disciplines that you would need to check off, like a hydration expert, a massage therapist.
But is that giving him an unfair advantage?
Well, I think he has an unfair advantage right now being a professional athlete that can train all day and not have to work another job. You know,
but there's other people in the race who are professional athletes, and they are not the same tier of professional athlete that Jim is.
True.
So it's like, if, you know, if Jim gets to save X number of minutes through aid stations, because all he has to do is stand there with his arms out and everything gets done for him perfectly. Every elite should have that opportunity then too, which then on the opposite, it's like maybe every elite just shouldn't have that opportunity and just like let people just go spectate the race. Cause you can still have a camera on you coming through the aid station, grabbing your drop bag, you know, doing all your stuff. And then as you're running out, the camera crew's panned down at the ground being like, oh no, it looks like Finn Melanson forgot to fill his water bottles.
Well, how about this? And this is just like a, this is just, is it fair to make the comparison to NASCAR? Like if NASCAR didn't have pit crews, would that fundamentally change the sport? And would it fundamentally change it for the worse?
Well, every crew in NASCAR has roughly the same number of people. They're all using the same tires. They're all using the same little gun thingies that take the lug nuts off. We're super technical here. Like the crews across a lot of motor racing has gotten pretty even. Same with cycling. Like every team car or every team can have two team cars. They have X number of bikes on the back. There's neutral support cars that have these wheels. These have, so everyone kind of gets the same amount of crew. And if you break those rules, there's, you know, penalties for that. We're not to a point at, say, a race like Western States where all of the elites have the same level of crew, which brought up another idea, which I think is worse, but also an interesting thought experiment was, what if at every single aid station, every runner had to spend a minimum amount of time at the aid stations to neutralize the aid stations? And then it became a pure running race. Like every single athlete has to spend 3 minutes at every aid station. So now, you know, you can have your crew and they can get everything done. You could probably also do it all yourself in 3 minutes. You know, looking at it from the lead standpoint.
Really,
and then once your time is up, you can leave and you can go run. And there's just no aid station advantage or disadvantage anymore in that race.
Don't you think that's really interesting? Yeah. Don't you think that over time, like let's just imagine that like in 2023, Jim Walmsley or Courtney DeWalter, like they add some new person or thing to their aid station routine that just gives them a crazy awesome advantage. Don't you think it's the case that like over time, there's just like an adoption curve where like more like the next year there'll be three people that use that same thing. And then after that, it's like 25% of the field is using it. And then like within 5 years, like every single person in the field is now has now adopted that strategy or that person. Wouldn't this all be neutralized if like aid stations follow like adoption curves in every other area of life?
Yeah, no, you're totally right. Like that is what ultimately progresses the sport. And as we're seeing the sport grow and essentially more money get put into the development of, you know, the gear side of the sport, those things are absolutely going to happen, but there might also then need to be rules for it. Like the rules also need to change. Because like that's the case, like with cycling and an F1, they change the rules every year. Like on, like there's a couple huge rules in cycling, you know, just the other year that passed where like, you're not allowed to get into a super tuck anymore, which is like sitting on the top tube of the bike and your butt's like underneath the seat because they claimed it's too dangerous. It is so fast. You turn into a rocket ship when you're going downhill and you're in a super tuck, and all the pros can safely do it. But they didn't want then other people out, like fans and spectators, seeing all the pros super tucking and being like, I'm going to super tuck down my driveway. And, you know, so then they banned it. And, you know, they made other, you know, there's countless lists of rule changes. Same with F1 as well. And it's all pertaining to like the gear and the advancement of the sport. They're like, yes, you're right. This is better for the sport within reason.
Yeah.
For the sake of, you know, fairness.
That's a really good example.
So it's like, yeah, I totally see where the gear and like the cooling tech, shoes, et cetera, all get better and better, but to a point, to what extent though? Like at what point then is it not even a running race anymore? Like my shoes just allow me to levitate and hover off the ground. Like you know, on road racing, they have shoe rules for the first time ever, you know, like with carbon plates and stack height limits. Those don't exist in trail yet.
Yeah. Well, assuming, I wanted to share this idea with you, and it does require the assumption that aid stations can be totally pimped out and all the best crews, et cetera.
Yeah.
But imagine and it may even be able to exist today. I'm not sure, but imagine 5 or 10 years from now, there's a technology. It's like an application on your phone. Or the runner is all connected. The runner has all of these biometric sensors on them, maybe even super small headphones in their ears. And all of the data from those sensors is being piped to an app on the crew's phone. It'll monitor their hydration levels, their sweat levels, their muscle fatigue, their pacing, their splits, et cetera. And it will help the crew make the most informed decision about how to treat that runner by the time they arrive. Also, if that microphone stuff exists or the headphone stuff exists, the runner can communicate with the crew a mile or two out from the aid station saying I need this ready, not this, not this. Left knee is hurting, and they can just be truly ready in advance. What do you think?
Dude, I think you just described cycling. All the tour teams have sweat monitors, blood glucose monitors, power meters on their bikes, heart rate monitors. They all have the team dietitians, the team car next to them has a cooler with hundreds of bottles with all their names written on it, with their exact formulas on it. And they all ride with team radios, and the team car is listening to the race radio, relaying information to all the riders. The riders have the ability to talk back to the radio, so they can get actively coached the entire time on when to push, when to let up, what the gaps are, etc.
Why don't we have that yet in our sport?
I don't actually know.
What's your speculation? Is there any rule against it?
USATF, they're banned. It's against the rules in road marathoning and on the track. It's banned. Trail, we're in the Wild West. Western states, there's no, as far as I know, there's no rule against it, because you can see exactly Western states what you can and cannot do. It's just a little bit easier on a bike to have a radio because you're not bouncing, because it's still a little unit, it's still stuff you'd have to carry. But if it was a tiny phone and an AirPod, that's not carrying too much. I guess on the other hand, there's no cell service at most of Western states. So it doesn't actually work, but in a hypothetical sense where it did, I think that would be hugely helpful, because there's so many times where the top 10 on both the men's and women's side are running by themselves. And if you knew exactly the gaps ahead and behind you, you would be able to gauge your effort and confidently know what's going on so much better.
And if there was a way for the fan to somehow be exposed to those, I know it would break strategy and stuff like that, but if there's a way for fans to somehow be a part of all of the conversation that's happening.
Well, that would be filtered through the commentators of the race. You and I would be in the booth for Western States commentating on the race. We would have access to all the race radio, and we would have signed basically agreements saying we're not going to break strategy, but we can talk about various bits and pieces of what's going on.
Yeah. This is why I don't want to part with aid stations.
I know. That's super fun. Cause you can listen to race radio, online. You can go for F1 races. There's this whole F1 subscription dashboard where you can see every single car's cockpit camera, as well as tune in to any one of their race radios during the race or qualifying or anything like that. So it exists in F1 actually.
Oh my gosh.
Yep.
Super cool.
Western States 2050. Everyone's going to have cameras implanted into their eyeballs, and we will have 369 different cameras to choose from. I think I just broke Finn's brain.
Bottom line, I need to get more into the cycling world, and we need to have a Tour de France watching party.
Okay, so next July, you will come to Ashland and stay at my house for 3 weeks. And every morning, we'll get up at 5 a.m., watch the Tour.
Love it. I think this is the perfect place to close Long Run Archives number 8. Hopefully in 2023, we'll have a slightly more regular monthly cadence, but this has been fun as always. And remember, folks, it'll be in the show notes, but this is another call to action to go subscribe to Conversational Pace and also to enter the contest. And yeah, just go do it. If you love this stuff, you'll love Conversational Pace as well. So go smash that subscribe button. Peace. Thanks for listening. Before we sign off, if you are a fan of the show, please consider supporting us with a rating and review in your podcast player, a donation on Patreon, or the use of our sponsor discount codes in the show notes. Thanks again. We really appreciate your support, really appreciate you listening. Until next time, I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and you have been listening to the Single Track Podcast.